Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. In his new book, We Refuse to Forget, journalist Caleb Gale tells the story of the freedmen of the Muscogee Creek Nation, relates the history of the tribal story over the past three centuries, but it also tells a much larger story of America's simplistic views on identity and race that has and still continues to marginalize people of color of all ethnic backgrounds. Through the story of Cow Tom, a member of the tribe who may or may not have been enslaved at some point, Cow Tom, who helped negotiate the treaties of 1866 between the federal government and the Muscogees, and eventually rose to become chief. He shares the story of his descendants who were tribal citizens until they were not, 1979 to be exact. Today, freedmen who were Muscogee, along with Choctaw, Seminole, and Chickasaw, continue to work to join the tribe that many of their grandparents were a part of. Caleb Gale grew up in Oklahoma, in Tulsa, as a matter of fact, and now teaches at Northeastern University in Boston. He's a winner of the Matthew Power Literary Reporting Award. Gale's writing has appeared in the New York Times, The Atlantic, The Guardian, and The New Republic. His book is titled We Refuse to Forget, A True Story of Black Creeks, American Identity, and Power. It's published by Riverhead Books. He'll be participating in a signing Wednesday evening at 7 o'clock, that's June 8th, at Magic City Books. He's my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Caleb Gale, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us, and welcome back virtually to your hometown.
Thank you so much, Rich. I'm itching to get back, and it's just so good to be talking to a fellow Tulsan. How are you?
I'm doing well, and you have written a remarkable story that I think all Tulsans and all people in Oklahoma need to read about Black Creeks, Black Muscogee Creeks, that are still now continue to fight for their rights as members of the tribe, of the nation. And this story sounds like it has intrigued you somewhat from childhood. I don't know if they still do it, but you know, when I was a kid in the late 60s, first grade, we were asked to hold up our hand if we were an Indian. And all over my classroom, hands would go up. And it was a wide array of people holding up their hands. And I assume that was for some federal funding issue. But you experienced that as well as a child, in some way or another, and that experience stayed with you. How did it influence your decision to fully investigate this disenfranchisement of Blacks who at one point had been members of the Muscogee Nation?
You know, I think my experience wasn't so as formalized as, you know, being asked to raise one's hand dependent upon their kind of ancestral background. But rather, I think people, especially young kids, when we first moved to Oklahoma from New York, we would be at, you know, church picnics and cookouts and whatever else, sports teams, practices, and kids would look who looks like me. And for your listeners, I'm a fairly dark-skinned Black guy who would say to me, look, I got Indian in me. And to me, it just sounded like an old wives' tale. I just kind of assumed that this was something of a myth, something of a fiction. But as time went on, and I, you know, decades later, while I was sitting in the newsroom of The Guardian, reading both the AP Newswire and the Tulsa World talk very explicitly about a group of Black people who were suing for reinstatement in the Muscogee Creek Nation, I found that those words, I got Indian in me, became a haunting element, right? And I kind of wanted, like any person who's being haunted, to kind of resolve that, to allay kind of the troubling nature of it. And I think it was troubling because it spoke to me then as a kid and spoke to me even more as an adult that, quite frankly, maybe the way in which we classify people or categorize people or identify people oftentimes is just a little too bereft, too lacking in its historical grounding. And that, in fact, these kids who were saying I got Indian in me perhaps had so much more, far more potency in the way in which they framed identity than perhaps even many adult Americans, right? And so for me, that haunting needed to be dealt with. And the best way I could deal with that was by writing on the page for people the story of those who likewise can say the same things that those kids once said.
Well, this is an ambitious book that really tells a really long history. Where did you begin this story at? What was the first thing you wanted to know about?
I think it started, you know, in archives. But those archives don't always have everything that we need to know, right? And there's a longer history and a longer discussion, maybe for another radio show or segment. But there's a longer story about how there are so many voices who are not included in the archives, sometimes on purpose. And so those archives had to be paired like wine and cheese with oral histories. And those oral histories then had to be paired with news articles from the 1800s. And those had to be paired with, you know, topographical analyses of what exactly life looked like in the eastern portion of Oklahoma, but then even more so, the trail walked by so many during Indian removal. So it zigged and it zagged. I wish very much so that I, you know, walked my way into the Library of Congress one day and sat in an archive for several hours every day for 6 months and then came out with a linear tale. But that's not what we had here, right? This was a bit more of an archipelago of attempts to really figure out how to give the reader an understanding of how to do that. And I think the last portion was also kind of diving into my own story, right? Mm. And giving the reader, especially readers who might not even be from Oklahoma, readers who might have no association with the idea that there were once people and still are people who can claim their ancestry both in what America would conventionally consider Black people and what people would consider people who are of the Muscogee Creek Nation, right? So I knew that by offering my story, I could perhaps provide a life raft to those as they cross the Rubicon of knowledge to learn more about this portion of history and even more so how this history affects everyone today, not just Oklahomans, not just those who would consider themselves Creek freedmen or Black Creek or members of the Muscogee Creek Nation themselves, but in fact, all people who reside in the United States of America.
You know, I found that to be very truthful as you were going through the book. You know, I think the notion that you write that to understand the issues of what constitutes contemporary tribal membership, we have to understand that past. And that past, that history, often reflects a single viewpoint that doesn't reflect the complexity of the story. So how do we get at the complexity of this story?
Yeah, how can readers themselves get there, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that, you know, one, provide, you know, for any reader out there, first, give yourself the grace, right, to understand that there are scholars aplenty, right, who have made portions of this history their life's work, their life, in fact. And so, and on top of that, given that a lot of these stories, I think, and would believe and also argue in the book, most people who wielded power and influence over how education was dispensed, how we memorialized the lives of those who are not white men, oftentimes relegated these stories and obscured these stories such that most people didn't figure them out. So the fact that even readers are showing up to even open and crack open this book, such as yourself, Rich, is in and of itself a great accomplishment. I think to get after the complexity, though, is to realize that there are boxes that we are placing ourselves and others into that we ourselves did not create, right? I don't think that you, Rich, or, you know, I, Caleb Gale, are responsible for the awful or good things that our ancestors did. But that doesn't negate the fact that what those folks did way back when bears impact on us today. And so to put it quite plainly, how do we get after the complexity? We have to first admit to ourselves that, one, we're not responsible for where we are, but we are responsible for rectifying all of the bad that has been done. And the one of the most singularly bad things we did is that we situated whiteness in America as central, right, at the center of society, and we placed almost everyone else on the periphery. And with that, we were then able to then use identity differences to then decide who was going to wield power, who was going to be most, you know, proximate to power. And so the thing that I would say is the way in which you can understand the complexities by admitting that to yourself, and then also realizing that this story, the story of one family that, you know, I tell from 1810 till now, really helps to illustrate all of these, you know, theoretical and difficult and complex concepts that we have in front of us today. So that's the way I would say is that, you know, anchor on the story whilst also admitting that, you know, none of us are perfect or excellent or so astute on these matters that we can't stand to learn just a little bit more.
You begin with the story of Cal Tom, a former black man who was a member of the Creek Nation, who was reduced to being considered a slave. And that, you said that really affected how he and his descendants have been regarded ever since. But this was a man who became chief of the nation after the Civil War. He helped negotiate the treaties that ended after the Civil War with the federal government. And yet he becomes reduced again through a simplification of identity and race. Tell us about Cal Tom and what we need to know about him.
Yeah. I think Cal Tom was, if you talk to his family, walk around the streets of Tulsa today, he was a never enslaved black man who had been engrafted into the Creek Nation as a member and as a citizen, who came over with Cat Yargi, one of the chiefs of the Creek Nation, and from the southeastern United States in the early 1800s, and settled in the eastern portion of Oklahoma. Now, the story essentially as it goes is that, you know, Ethan Allen Hitchcock, I found his diaries where he would remark on all of the different people he met when during the early 1800s, the first half 1800s, where he was interacting with people from all over what was then Indian territory, and was coming to grips with a host of different issues that he saw, right? And in one of his diary entries, one of his journal entries, he interacted with Yargi, who had an interpreter whose name was Cal Tom. And instead of kind of recognizing the potential that Cal Tom could be his own man, that Cal Tom could be a freed black man, he instead rested on the boxes that Ethan Allen Hitchcock didn't create, but that he acceded to, that Cal Tom couldn't be much more than anything but Cat Yargi's Negro, his slave. And so that marker we see come up throughout the legacy of Cal Tom's descendants, who, though they went on to great exploits in part because of the work that Cal Tom did, emerging as what he called Miko, or as a chief within the nation, negotiating treaties on behalf of the Creek Nation that included, in particular, the peace treaty in 1866, which entitled Black people that were owned by the Creek Nation to be emancipated. And then on top of that, also provided them the status of full citizenship, which gave his family, you know, access to so much opportunity, along with many other Black families in the history of Oklahoma and Indian Territory. But yet and still, you know, almost 100 years later, when the Dawes Commission, which was, you know, founded to kind of split up Oklahoma and identify who was going to get what based on their definition of citizenship, which was based on race, not tribal affiliation, those folks who were descended from Cal Tom got recorded as freedmen, right? As people who were once enslaved and now freed. So despite all of the work that Cal Tom did, despite the emergence of leadership at the time when it was needed most, his identity was relegated to being that person who was enslaved, as Ethan Allen Hitchcock recorded, just Cat Yargi's Negro. So that's the kind of the sad tale for a lot of us. And when we think about where we are today as a country, that I, Caleb Gale, I think to myself, I've done all that I can. I've graduated from great schools. I've gone to great companies and worked and done well, but oftentimes I'm relegated to fitting strictly into the box of being just another black guy. And with that comes associated all of these perceived biases that people have developed over time.
I'm gathering that idea that this officer basically saw Cal Tom not as an interpreter, not as an advisor, not as a confidant, but simply a hand.
Exactly. He relegated his opportunity and his potential to everything. He superimposed all the notions of racism on Cal Tom and used that racism as a confining element. And it's sad to say. I wish that I could report to you, Rich, that this is wholly and completely uncommon throughout history and now.
Of course, but we know that's not the case.
Yeah, exactly. But as a journalist, I'm bound by facts, and those wouldn't be facts, right? So, yes, that's exactly right.
I mean, that's sort of an underpinning for what later happened to these descendants of black members of the nation in the 1970s, when basically they were disenfranchised. It was
Exactly.
that sort of box checking, if you will.
Exactly, definitely. And you can't, to some extent, it almost feels so common for us to do, right? The brain wants to associate people with different people groups and to kind of engage in some sort of sorting process. But if we don't wield kind of the heft of history when crafting these identities that no one asked us to craft, we have a tendency of stripping people of their humanity, right? And so when Ethan Allen Hitchcock looked at Cal Tom and said Negro, his Cat Yargi's Negro Tom, he stripped Cal Tom of some of his humanity. When we look at people today and we mark them, we strip their humanity. And so I think that the story of Cal Tom and his descendants really kind of illuminates what we do all the time, right? I think Tulsa especially has a unique history that is kind of the outworking, the dangerous outworking of what happens when we preload a bunch of categories for people that they didn't ask for.
My guest today is Caleb Gale, a journalist, professor at Northeastern University, and he's the author of We Refuse to Forget, A True Story of Black Creeks, American Identity and Power. It's published by Riverhead Books, and he'll be participating in an event with Magic City Books, 7 o'clock on Wednesday evening. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, as you told the story of the Dawes Commission and when they were partitioning the reservations, if you will, of the tribes in eastern Oklahoma. Again, it was a matter of setting aside land for each family. That's not the first time that the American government or the colonial government was trying to do the same thing. And you write about the early interactions between the nation and Europeans coming to America and how their relationship, how the Muscogees' relationship with their lands and attitudes towards enslavement changed over time. How did those practices evolve? I mean, it was very interesting how you talked about how in the very early days, the nation basically tried to be neutral. It stayed out of the European wars that were fought in the eastern United States over, who's going to control the New World, if you will. And they kept themselves at arm's lengths from communities where chattel slavery was taking place.
Right. So the I think you keyed on something really important there, Rich. So yes, the notion of chattel slavery was not one that was welcomed with warm arms by the Creek Nation, right? But after first the British and then what then became the colonial government and then what became the American government emerged, right? The United States had for some time, kind of identified the Creek, Muscogee Creek Nation, along with all of the others, as a problem, right? That they wanted to solve, help that none of these nations asked for, especially as they tried to keep their distance. And you had certain key figures. One key figure that I talk about in the book at length, Benjamin Hawkins, who operates as this agent on behalf of four different US presidents at the start of what we now consider the US government, who really tried his best to both instill the fear that comes with representing a new nation that has an insatiable desire to subjugate the people therein and move even more further west and south, whilst at the same time introducing certain practices like privatization of land, the uprooting of various customs that they had deemed not capitalistically efficient. And so people like Benjamin Hawkins really kind of over time presented a false choice, right? Either you participate in the demise, either you participate in slowing the demise, the what seemed like the inevitable demise of your way of life, or you resist only to be overcome swiftly and have your way of life fall apart, right? Angie DeBow, a famed historian, called it the path to destruction, the road to disappearance. And so ever since the United States government emerged as kind of the victor of many battles, and as they turned their attention towards kind of instilling true potency in their federal government, right? Ever since then, of course, before, but ever since then, they were explicitly trying to put many of these nations, all of these nations, on a road to disappearance. And that included oftentimes presenting them with practices that they otherwise would never have agreed to, such as slavery.
And eventually they began to evoke some of those practices before, again, being removed from their homelands and moving here to Oklahoma. That certainly happened. That evolution did.
Definitely. Definitely. And it also had the unique, the difference, though, I want to really make sure that your listeners understand, is that even still, chattel or not, right, slavery within the history of the Creek Nation was not in any way hereditary, right? So in the United States, chattel slavery kind of implies that you lose all of your humanity, you become property, you become a means of production for which no one has to pay, and everyone can boss around and subjugate to terrible and inhumane conditions. But the latter half of it is that your children, your children's children, everyone you know is now a slave. And that really, even in the course of the ways in which the Muscogee Nation operated, and very much so when it came to the practice of slavery, no matter how abhorrent any type of slavery is, the hereditary nature of it did not necessarily persist. Which is an important distinction, right? That kind of demonstrates the lingering distaste for the practice within the Creek Nation.
Well, the book has a really interesting history of early Tulsa and the Perrymans here in Tulsa, and how there were Black members of the nation as a part of that family, or mixed race members of that family in the founding of Tulsa Town. But I do want to switch forward a few years, and that is the idea of blood quantum, which is the federal government used it when they were allotting land through the Dawes Commission. It's been used by tribal governments to determine membership. Was that always important in tribal governments and in within the tribe itself? Was that always an important determining point?
No, it wasn't always, right? And you know, it's always a pleasure talking to folks who are Tulsans who might, you know, have a greater degree of understanding as to what that is and where it comes from. But no, it wasn't always important. In fact, it was and still stands today as an unscientific way of reducing kind of the complexity of that history, of that, you know, multitude of identity components, reducing it to how people might determine, especially back when it was not founded, but introduced many of these nations, when it was, you know, reduced people to how many identity characteristics could nullify or validate what a white man might assume to be someone who is of this nation's citizenship or not, right? And that is, it turned what would have strictly been a, you know, political nation, a political entity, into an entity that was really constituted around race. And we know that race is a social construct. It doesn't exist beyond the ways in which we create it to exist and we empower it to persist. And so, no, it was not always that way, but it definitely took hold, right? And it took hold really at the precise time that scientific racism was also taking hold, where people were actively trying to identify, could there be a way to explain away the responsibility that much of white America has and has had for the challenges faced by those who are not white? Is there a way to kind of cobble together enough faux science such that it sounds real? And so blood quantum, even back then, oftentimes could be determined by an assemblage of ancestral paperwork or records, but also could have been done in some cases by an eyeball test. And what was sad is that even for the families, the Black families who back then were citizens of the Creek Nation and onward, a lot of those very people became all of a sudden too black to be fully black and fully Creek, right? The duality, the holding of two distinct but related identities became harder to maintain in both the eyes of the U.S. government and later on in the eyes of, sadly, the Muskogee Creek Nation.
And of course, they were disenfranchised in the late 1970s. And I mean, this case has been going on a long time. What is the status of the work of these former members to regain their membership in the nation?
Sure. So I think that, like, you know, there's different types of work that achieve different aims. I think what's fascinating is that I'm sure for a lot of Tulsans who are going to be listening into this broadcast, I'm certain that there will be a, you know, statistically significant portion of them who will be surprised that this is actually the case, that there were ever Black people who were citizens of the Creek Nation, that there were Black people who were disenfranchised from that nation, there were Black people who led that nation, and those Black people were some of the founding families who created what was then Tulsi Town that became Tulsa, that the first post office was run by a person who was related to a Black Creek chief. So all of this is going to have a certain recency to it. But so to that end, educating the public, creating kind of the groundswell of information such that people can relearn and unlearn some of the ways in which we learn history, such that they can open themselves up to the idea that this even happened, right? So I think that's one, and that's always going to continue. But I think also, you know, there was a legal case over the, there are legal cases over the past couple of years. You know, it has not panned out or redounded to the victory of these folks, but, you know, it doesn't take much to then look at how the Cherokee Nation was defeated by people like Marilyn Vann and some of her counterparts to kind of readmit many Black people who were once citizens of the Cherokee Nation. So there I think is always the pathway, and as such will always perhaps be a legal remedy, right? And of course, there are others like Maxine Waters, who has, in some instances, called to account for various subcommittees in the House of Representatives within the U.S. Congress to review these sorts of issues. And congressmen like Danny Davis, who have from Illinois, who's taken up this issue in the past, who wants to figure out if perhaps there's a policy remedy to this as well. So I think there's a multi-pronged approach, right? Education, legal remedies, and perhaps even policy or political remedies as well.
The name of the book is We Refuse to Forget. Caleb, thanks so much for joining us.
Rich, I so appreciate you making the time.
Journalist Caleb Gale speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He's a native Tulsan and now a professor at Northeastern University in Boston, Massachusetts. His new book is titled We Refuse to Forget, A True Story of Black Creeks, American Identity and Power. It's published by Riverhead Books. He'll be participating in a signing and a book talk Wednesday evening, June 8th at 7 o'clock at Magic City Books. You can learn more at magiccitybooks.com. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.